Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Rich Cohen, whose new book is Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. We'll also hear from Mary Fitzpatrick, who's the co-editor with Virginia McCollum, of a gorgeous new book about New Orleans called Days and Nights in the Dreamy City. Locals share their favorite places. Rich Cohen is one of my favorite writers, plain and simple. Whenever you open up one of his books, you know you're in for a great ride. He grew up in Chicago, went to Tulane University, and now lives in Connecticut. He's the author of 9 books. New Orleans readers will especially remember his 8th, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King, a biography of Samuel Zemure, head of United Fruit. Now Rich is back with a wonderful book about football, Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. Rich Cohen, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you just couldn't resist the lure of writing about sports, huh?
Well, it was actually sports that brought me to New Orleans because I went down to see Super Bowl XX when I was a senior in high school in the Superdome and never left.
I love that because it begins and ends with that trip, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if you live in Chicago and January 23rd you go to New Orleans, you don't want to go home.
But that's where you are now. We're talking to you in Chicago, actually.
Yeah.
Now, we all have incredible loyalty to the cities where we grew up and their sports teams, but you make the case that being a Chicago fan is really something special.
Well, yeah, I mean, I once saw a kid with a T-shirt that said Chicago Cubs World Champs in big letters and little tiny letters that said 1908. You know, and when I was growing up, the last team to have won anything was the Bears, who'd won in 63, 5 years before I was born. So we didn't win. You know, my father grew up in Brooklyn, and he used to tell me not to be a Cubs fan. He said a Cubs fan will accept losing as a natural condition of life and thus have a bad life. But you can't help where you're born, and you can't help where your loyalties are, and I came to love those teams. And then around the 1980s, the Bears started to become not only really great, but really, really colorful. And they developed this amazing team with the 46 defense. That was the team of the Super Bowl shuffle, and it was just made of outsized personalities like Dan Hampton, Mike Ditka, The Fridge, Walter Payton, you know, and Jim McMahon, my favorite player. And it was just, to me, it was like being young in Paris or something. Following that team was really one of the great years of my life.
I know. I enjoyed reading about your bromance with Jim McMahon, I have to say. Now, in diving into the Bears' long history, you talk a lot about how they revolutionized the game. The T formation, which elevated the position of the quarterback, that was something really important that the Bears contributed, right?
Yeah, I mean, the quarterback has become almost like an astronaut or a cowboy. It's like an American archetype. But when football started, there really wasn't the quarterback position. George Halas, who started the Bears as the Decatur Staley, the factory team, really founded the NFL. He realized, because of the change in rules, that he could have this new position, a quarterback, which was in essence a coach on the field. And it would be an incredibly complicated position that would require an incredibly smart person to run it. And he elevated the quarterback. All the modern football you watch is so based on the quarterback. That was really George Halas working originally with Sid Luckman. And the big realization for the 85 Bears is the quarterback is so important. And rather than try to chase 10 guys all over the field, let's just kill one. Whereas Doug Plank, who was number 46 and gave the 46 defense its name, told me, football is tackle chess.
Yes.
Take all my pawns, but I knock over your king. I win. Quarterback is the king.
It reminded me of the Harry Potter thing. Wizard chess is very violent. You know?
Yeah, they already have wizard chess. It's called the NFL.
Now, the other thing you talk about is the change. They began putting emphasis on the air game.
Yeah, well, you know, football is interesting because it's like studying the history of like an ideology because it slowly developed. And if you look at football and how it changed, it really reflects what's going on in warfare in the world. During World War I, they played pro football. It was a game of attrition. It was trenches. It was guys going 2 or 3 yards and all piling up on each other. After World War II, it became this incredible air game. And it's hard to think it wasn't connected, you know, at least in some subconscious way to what happened in World War II. And they even took those terms like the blitzkrieg and the bomb, and they used them for football. And football really became, you know, you see it with the Saints especially. It's like what the old coaches now refer to as basketball on the grass. It's high scoring, very fast, and sometimes it seems like the defense doesn't have a chance. And the last golden age defense was the 85 Bears, and the new offense that we all see is a reaction to the 85 Bears.
And one of the things you do so well is that you move beyond mere biography to some of the spiritual dimensions of the sport. And I love that passage you wrote about, how does the quarterback represent us?
Yeah, well, when you watch football, you usually identify with the quarterback because football is a game where the players are in armor. You can't see their faces. It's hard to recognize their personalities. But the quarterback becomes this sort of almost existential figure in my mind, like the man alone, the man in the pocket. When you're a kid and you watch a quarterback, it teaches you how to live and how different people live. You know, some guys go out very quickly. Some guys play hurt. And some guys, I always found most amazing, is the quarterbacks that find a way to play when they're old, when their physical skills are diminished, and they're just existing surely on kind of their intellect and kind of a prayer. And those guys are models for not only how to play games, I always think for how to live. And I think football players, in such a violent game, they kind of die twice, you know. They die like the rest of us, but they also die in the game. Everything they wanted and hoped for, they have to walk away from when they're still, you know, young men and usually pretty beaten up physically.
Oh, and you really make the case for the fleeting nature of this triumph. I mean, it's just over so soon.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. You know, you see a guy like Walter Payton, who was in Chicago. They called him Sweetness, and he was such a great runner. And he dreamed his whole life of getting to the Super Bowl, and he got to the Super Bowl, and it was over, you know.
Yeah.
And you feel this tremendous letdown, even as a fan. It just goes away so fast, and it's kind of hokey. But to me, sports really are like a metaphor for life. And it's so hard to, like, live in that moment when you're young and you're with your friends, and life takes you away from that. And to me, these group, the Bears, one of the reasons they were great, the 85 Bears, is they clearly were having a great time, and they clearly loved each other. And it was like a band of brothers. And if they could, they would have stayed together forever, but life doesn't allow you to do that. And I sort of thought by tracing what happened to them after the sort of dream came true, you sort of told the story of every different kind of American life because, you know, the most successful of them, like Gary Fensick, who was on that team, becomes a private equity guy who makes more money outside the game than he ever did inside. To Mike Richardson, who played right next to Fensick, who winds up a few years later in prison.
It's amazing. The sheer range of it is so amazing. Talk a little bit about George Halas for us. I love the image you have of that photograph of him with Ty Cobb.
Yeah. Well, in Chicago, George Halas was kind of a god. By the time I was a kid, he was seen as this miserly kind of old man out of Dickens. But, of course, that really wasn't true. He had this amazing life. He was a great athlete, went to the University of Illinois, and he was a great baseball player. He played one season with the Yankees. The most notorious things that happened to him there is, one, he almost got in a fist fight with Ty Cobb. And then he got cut because he couldn't hit a curveball, sent to the minors, and was replaced by Babe Ruth. And he winds up, you know, he was a civil engineer. He was working for an engineering company when he got a call from this guy, A.E. Staley, who owned a big starch company in Decatur, Illinois. And he wanted to start a factory football team. And he asked Halas if he'd come down and start this team for him. And Halas loaded the team up with former Big Ten football stars, and they all got kind of no-show jobs. So they got paid, but they didn't work at Staley Starch. And they built this football team called the Decatur Staleys. And George Halas was a guy who always wanted to be in first. His favorite expression was the old zipperoo. That was for guys who played with a lot of energy and always got up once more than they were knocked down. And there was no way to know you were in first when there was no league to keep score. So he started with a few other guys the National Football League. And eventually he moved them from Decatur Staleys to the Chicago Bears. He was a great player on the Bears. He once stripped the ball from Jim Thorpe and ran 90 yards for a touchdown. Then became a great coach. He won his last championship in 63 with Mike Ditka as a great tight end, the first modern tight end. And then Ditka made this comment. He said, George Halas is so cheap, he throws around nickels like they're manhole covers. That got Ditka booted from the Bears. He came back when Halas was an old man to take over as coach. And Halas gave Ditka this bottle of Dom Perignon champagne and said, open it when you win the Super Bowl. And it happened 2 years after Halas died.
Oh, man. Now, have you been to any Super Bowls since the 86 one?
Yep, I went to another one. I've been to two. When I was a senior at Tulane, my roommate from college had gone off and become like a sportscaster in Charlotte. And he came back with tickets to the Super Bowl, and we saw the San Francisco 49ers play the Denver Broncos, two of the greatest quarterbacks, Joe Montana and John Elway. But I think it was the only game that was a bigger blowout than the Bears-Patriots game I saw in 86.
So one of the things you do in this book is that you bring in all the current problems and the debates, and you talk about the way fans have been removed a bit, that it has become kind of a rich man's sport in a way. And you talk a lot about traumatic brain injury. You know, that there's a gamble for these guys if they'll have a future if they get too hard. And I thought it was really interesting when you asked Jim McMahon about that.
Yeah, well, Jim McMahon was, first of all, the 85 Bears had this player named Dave Duerson, who was an all-pro. And Dave Duerson was the guy who a couple of years ago, fearing he had this brain disease, shot himself in the chest. And before he did it, I mean, talk about of the times, he wrote a suicide note as a text message to his family. And he said he was killing himself and shooting himself in the chest so his brain would be preserved for study, so the disease could be understood. And he was that sure that he had it. So when I talked to these guys, I went around interviewing these guys 28 years after the Super Bowl, it was on all of their minds. And McMahon especially, because if you ever saw Jim McMahon play, one of the great things about him is he played like a crazy man. Ditka said he was a guy who thought he was a linebacker. And he'd seek out contact, he'd smash into people, he'd go head first. And he's had problems. And when I met him, though, actually, he was phenomenally great talking about stuff that happened 30 years ago. But it is amazing, the physical toll. I had this idea that this book could be like my father's favorite book, The Boys of Summer, in a way, which was Roger Kahn's book about the 55 Brooklyn Dodgers. It was an iconic book. And Roger Kahn went around and interviewed those old Brooklyn Dodgers, and at the end of each interview, he'd ask the guys if they wanted to play catch. And they would go out in the gloaming, and they would play catch in the wheat fields, and the dogs would run by, and the sun would go down. It was this beautiful scene. And I thought I would have the same experience. When I went to see McMahon, I brought a football with me, and I asked him if he wanted to play catch. And he just sort of laughed and gripped his shoulder and said, "Play catch, man. I can't even throw my keys."
Heartbreaking. But when you ask him if he'd do it all again.
Yeah, he says he would do it again. And what's amazing is nothing. Jim McMahon, his rookie year, made $60,000. The year the Bears won the Super Bowl, they won $100,000. They gave their sort of bodies, and some of them gave their minds for this game. But when you ask them if they do it again, every one of them said yes. And when you ask them what they miss, it's not the money, it's not the games, it's hanging out with their friends in the locker room before and after the game.
Well, and one of the things, one of the things that we all remember, too, is the Super Bowl shuffle.
Yeah.
And you write about that with great nostalgia.
I mean. Yeah, I was thinking about it. You know, you feel both pride and shame when you hear it now.
Yeah.
And the pride is the joy of your 17-year-old self, and the shame is the reality of your 45-year-old self, you know,
and
working
you see,
against each other.
And you see those players at the height of their abilities, which is really kind of charming, I have
it's
to say, still.
They could play defense better than they could dance.
Right. No kidding. Whoa. Oh, we've been talking with Rich Cohen, whose fast-paced and fascinating new book is Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. You can meet him Tuesday, December 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Rich.
Thank you.
Fitzpatrick is the executive editor of the Preservation Resource Center's much-loved publication, Preservation in Print. And along the way, she's put together some charming books about New Orleans, Life in an Epic City, New Orleans' Favorite Shotguns, and now the third book in the trilogy celebrating the PRC's 40th anniversary. It's called Days and Nights in the Dream City. Locals share their favorite places. So, Mary, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. I'm proud to be invited.
Well, this book is so much fun. Tell us how you went about putting it together.
By asking everybody we knew in person or via email. We did surveys online. However it went, we ask.
How long a period of time did you devote to gathering these stories?
The real gathering took place in the last 2 years, but I had actually been doing this for probably 20 years at Preservation in Print because it was always so much a part of the stories we wrote.
Of course. And I bet it led you to some unexpected stories, too.
Absolutely. It really did. To find out why people like their neighborhoods or where they went in the middle of the night really got us going down some rabbit warrens.
And I noticed a lot of the participants in the book are in the film industry.
That is because Virginia McCollum, my co-author, is a location manager, and she was location manager for Treme, so you see a lot of great writers and film people from Treme. And American Horror Story, which is making quite a splash right now on TV. So she has a lot of friends in the film industry.
And they look at the city with a kind of particular eye, don't you think?
I really do. They look at it for its cinematic attributes. And they also, particularly the people from Treme, seem to have a great affinity for Frenchman Street. And that was fun to hear all their opinions about the different clubs.
And they're not the only ones. Mark Childress talks about Frenchman Street as well. Why don't you read what he has to say?
Okay. I've always thought Mark Childress was such a fun author, and I'm delighted that he agreed to be in our book and also push it on his Facebook page, which is really nice for us. Okay, this is what Mark says. And for those of you who don't know, he is very well known for the novel Crazy in Alabama. So Mark says, "One of my favorite things to do on a sweltering evening is to arm myself with a cool libation and to walk with friends over to Frenchman Street. I like to stand in the street and hear the music coming out of the doors. I like to walk up and down and sample a Marsalis here, a horn stomper there, some reggae boys down at the end of the block. Oh, and who the hell is the new chanteuse at the Spotted Cat? And why is she great in a way that singers are never great in any other city but New Orleans?"
I love him. I do. You know, you just have to love him. So what is your favorite place?
My favorite place is downtown neighborhoods. The colorful blocks of Creole shotguns and historic 19th century houses. I love to ride around there on my bicycle and then go around the corner, and suddenly there's music on a stoop, live music, brass music. I love that. I've run into some great people like Shamar Alexander and even Trombone Shorty down there.
Oh, nice. And then what places were new to you? I mean, I always think of you as having this encyclopedic knowledge of New Orleans, but it's hard to have that in a way, you know?
Well, that's nice to say, because at Preservation Resource Center, we're constantly called on by people, where should I go? What should I do? What neighborhood? So to do days and nights in the Dreamy City prepared me better to be the person you think I am. But I didn't know so many dive bars. I'm older, so I didn't know Snake and Jake's. I didn't know Bocat Lounge. I didn't know the Hi-Ho Lounge or the Cajun Pub on St. Claude. And it was really fun to hear some of these people, like the Duplass brothers, that great writing and directing team that grew up and went to Jesuit, talk about a night at Snake and Jake's. I didn't know about the swings at the Port Authority building, and that groups of people, friends, go hang out there at dusk and have a drink.
I have to say, those swings at the Port Authority building were new to me too, and they made me want to go. Absolutely, just that vision.
Another quote that made me want to go was a writer talking about early mornings in the quarter when they're putting the district together, when the fish trucks are making deliveries, when the street cleaners are out there, when people are walking their dogs. It made me want to experience it so much that we rented an apartment down there for a couple of nights in order to be part of that serene scene in the quarter.
And you've arranged this book chronologically. So talk about that, about the different feelings of time passing.
It turned out to be arranged from morning to night because that's the way people approach what they like best. You found people that like the morning or who go to coffee shops like Sacred Grinds or Boulangerie in different parts of town. And then it went all through the day to whereby people like to go out to dinner at Cote Sud or Mobar or whatnot. up until people who wanted to be at Giacomo's sitting in the truck out on Oak Street, you know, at 2 a.m. So it was the way people answered the questions that led to that.
Did you have to leave anybody out? I'm very curious.
Yes, yes. I have been sending a number of little apology notes because this book is a quarter larger than any of the other books that I've done for Preservation Resource Center. And we just had to cap it at 152 pages, unfortunately. And a lot of what guided our choice was the quality of the photographs.
And who took the photographs?
This was fun. Okay, we had Charles Lesh, who was a partner at Deutsch Kerrigan Law Firm. We have James Shaw, who does a great daily blog called NOLA Daily. We had Mark Sindler, who had done New Orleans Life in an Epic City with me a number of years ago, and he is the photographer for the Louisiana Culture, Recreation, and Tourism, but who has photographs that they're not using and that I could use. And then this new young transplant to New Orleans, Olivia Moran, who graduated with a degree in Photoshop or digital manipulation of photographs. She saw preservation in print in the French Quarter and loved the photographs in the magazine and liked the magazine and called me to see if she could volunteer. She works regularly as a waitress at Vacherie in the Quarter, so it was a gold mine of a find for us.
Oh, nice. And that's one of the wonderful things about this book. The photographs really are so crisp and gorgeous. And it's as up-to-date as Ferret Street, the great Renaissance on Ferret.
We were working till the last minute. We really were. And I like the fact that the age of the photographers is quite varied, so that what they were comfortable photographing went from outside of Snake and Jake's, you know, at 3 a.m. to the levee in Holy Cross at twilight. It was very nice.
I love that. But I think that's what we all do. We all love to say what we love best about living here. It's just that kind of place.
It was fun making people narrow it down because the first reaction is, oh, there's so much. And I think, now, come on. Where do you take visitors when they come in town? Or where do you go when you have a Sunday afternoon? Or where do you tell people to go that say, I want to spend the day outside? So I've gotten a lot of leads on what I want to do, too.
And there are some really traditional, wonderful places like Hanson Snowblitz and, you know, Guy's Po' Boy Stand. I mean, it's just the best.
Even Café du Monde. I was surprised how many native New Orleanians chose Café du Monde as their favorite place to go, not even with out-of-town visitors.
It's just a special place. Like, every place in this book is special, really.
Did you know you could kayak right up to Morning Call in City Park?
No, that I thought was very cool.
I didn't know that either. I didn't, and I didn't know that people hung out on Magnolia Bridge and drank wine in the evening on Bayou St. John.
Magnolia Bridge is also a popular place for marriage proposals, which I like a lot. You know, it's very dear, isn't it?
It is.
Well, we've been talking with Mary Fitzpatrick of the Preservation Resource Center, whose new book, with Virginia McCollum, is Days and Nights in the Dreamy City, Locals Share Their Favorite Places. You can meet Mary December 7th at the Preservation Resource Center from 5:30 to 7:30, and she'll be at the Rink December 10th from 5 to 9 with Garden District Bookshop's Christmas Party. And then at the Holiday Home Tour, December 14th through 15th, and December 21st at Octavia Books from 2 to 4. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you, Susan.
Our visiting poet today is Andy Young, who's the co-editor of MENA, a bilingual Arabic-English literary journal based in Alexandria and New Orleans. Andy also teaches at NOCA, and her most recent book is The People is Singular. Andy will be reading I've Got Oranges and Bananas for us today. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Susan. I've got oranges and bananas. Our two-year-old heard Mr. Okra, New Orleans fruit seller, in the call to prayer when we visited Egypt, I used to think he was a preacher, too. For years, I thought he was a preacher. Allahu Akbar, a gospel of ripeness. Oka, Oka, she'd shout to her cousins in the village where, loved but dumb, I managed my first Arabic conversation. Ustaz Bamia, I said, then cupped my hands.
Andi tumatam, andi mos waportawan.
And was finally understood, had almost made a joke. Though I could not say, I don't know when we can return, or your son is safe in America. Mr. Okra, I cannot hear you now without thinking of Tunisia, of Bouazizi, his cart seized the last time, of how he doused himself with kerosene and struck that first match.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Matt Sacchettini's Sons Roll With It, Brass Bands in the Streets of New Orleans, Tuesday, December 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Chef John Besh signs Cooking from the Heart, My Favorite Lessons Learned Along the Way, Tuesday, December 3rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Christy Jordan signs Come Home to Supper, Over 200 Casseroles, Skillets, and Size, Desserts Too, to Feed Your Family with Love, Wednesday, December 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Rich Cohen, signs Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football, Thursday, December 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Mary Fitzpatrick, and contributors sign New Orleans, Days and Nights in the Dreamy City, Saturday, December 7th from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Preservation Resource Center, and again, Tuesday, December 10th from 5 to 9 at Garden District Bookshop. Daniel Chacon reads from and signs Hotel Juarez, Stories, Rooms, and Loops, along with Jonathan Klein reading from and signing Wisdom of Ashes, Monday, December 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. Michael Alenzel appears with Louvier and Vanessa at the launch of their new collaborative work, The Oblivion Atlas, Tuesday, December 10th at 7 at the Black Widow Salon at Crescent City Books. And here's something really special. Metairie Park Country Day School and the Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans present an evening with Lucinda Dickens Hawksley, the great-great-great-granddaughter of Charles Dickens. Her most recent book is Charles Dickens' Favorite Daughter, The Life, Loves, and Art of Katie Dickens Perugini. She appears Tuesday, December 10th at 7 at Metairie Park Country Day School's Bright Library. And coming up fast, Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, takes place this week, December 4th through 8th at the Hotel Monteleone. The theme this year is God, Man, and Woman, Faith and the Search for Meaning as Inspiration for the Arts. Featured speakers include Reza Aslan, author of Zealot, The Life of Jesus of Nazareth, Horacio Castellanos Moya, author of Senselessness, Tom Franklin and Beth Ann Fenley, authors of The Tilted World, Walker Percy biographer Patrick Samway, novelist Ron Rash, author of Serena, Roger Kamenetz, author of To Die Next to You, Maura Crone, author of The Not Yet, and Lisa Zeidner, whose most recent book is Love Bomb. For the complete schedule of events, check out wordsandmusic.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.